Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Coming up on today's episode, the politics of petrol. Have you been to the petrol station recently, filled up your car and discovered prices have really gone up over the last few months? They've actually hit an almost eight-year high. We'll examine why they've gone up, what the impact is on drivers, but also, is it necessarily a bad thing? Might it encourage us to switch to greener forms of getting about? That's our big thing in a moment. But first, it's our columnist panel. It's Tuesday, so it must be Finkelvich's Danny Finkelstein and David Ivanovich. But anyway, it's nice to have you with us, and we've got off on the usual by squabbling about even your introduction. So let's talk about Boris Johnson's announcement last night, lifting of all restrictions, and we appear to be entering a new culture war based entirely on whether or not you're going to wear a mask. Who is going to win this war, do you think, Danny?
Danny Finkelstein and David Ivanovich there.
Well, this morning I noticed that Wright said, Fred said that he wouldn't work with me if I wore a mask, which is
adding an extra
layer of complexity to my decision and to all of ours. So I think that people will not wear a mask in quite the quantities that Twitter anticipates that they will. I mean, even when it was effectively compulsory on the tubes, a really quite large proportion of people didn't wear it. I think when the tube is very packed, people will wear it, even though we know that really it's for other people, they'll wear it partly for themselves, and they'll feel they catch less colds doing it. So I think there will remain a reasonable amount of mask wearing, but it will be by no means universal. I think the preponderance of people and places will not wear masks.
What do you think, David? And also, I'm just quite intrigued about how it's become the new, well, at least on social media. I suspect in the real world this is not the case, but at least on social media, how it does seem to have become the new Brexit as to whether or not you are a freedom-loving non-mask wearer, or, you know, a sort of virtuous signalling, it's the other people I really care about, which is why I'm wearing mine. Maybe it's not a great surprise that everything now becomes a culture war.
Well, I was listening to a radio program which gave a synopsis of a Daily Mail column which has gone out today, saying there's going to be civil war between mask wearers and non-mask wearers. And apparently what's going to happen is we're going to batter each other on the tube and on the buses. We're actually going to come to kind of significant blows in the shops and so on, because non-mask wearers will feel reproached by mask wearers and will attack them, and mask wearers will feel threatened by non-mask wearers and attack them. And though there may be one or two instances of this which will instantly be uploaded to social media, my firm prediction is that none of that will happen whatsoever. By and large, as far as I can see from most of the polling evidence, people take a fairly sensible attitude towards this, which is where it's very crowded and you're very indoors, it's quite a good idea for as many people as possible to continue wearing masks for the time being. And I'd add to that, I do remember interviewing a virologist about 20 years ago, about 15 years ago, for a book he'd written. And he said to me, you know that thing that mostly Chinese and people seem to do, which is they wear masks on the tube. I said, is that silly? He said, no, if you know anything about virology, that's pretty sensible. I'd do it myself, he said, but we do tend to look ridiculous. Well, now I know it's sensible. I think in kind of flu and cold season, the old hand gel routines and the hand washing routines and a bit of the old mask wearing, I think I'm prepared to tolerate being ridiculed. So I don't think any of that will happen. I think people will be as pretty much sensible as they've been right the way through this business, no matter how much people have kind of tried to capitalise on the idea that they've not been sensible.
And I was, I mean, it's one, because I've been quite surprised that actually initially when we were supposed to start wearing masks on the tube, I was quite struck that actually quite a lot of people didn't. But I did, because it was raining this morning, so I did get the tube from Waterloo. And I looked around because I knew we were going to be having this conversation. Every single person had a mask on this morning. The same is true on the trains when I come in. And so I do wonder whether actually just sort of society will just find its level. There will just be somehow, without being told, we'll just work out the times when you do put one on and there are times when you don't. And it will just, you know,
to give you an example, Matt, you currently have to wear it on the platform, which is outside at Pinner, as well as when you get on the train. I certainly won't do that. I'm standing outside and my glasses are misting up. I'm surprised if I don't fall down the gap between the train and the platform. But I do it because it's, you know, the rule and everything. But on the train, I think David's right. I think that I will when it's crowded. I think lots of people won't. I think it will be almost certainly a minority that do. Maybe in the short term it won't, and I think it'll take us a while to get back to old habits, but over time I suspect it will be a minority, but not zero.
And what about the sort of the broader question of part of the reason that there's sort of these two camps of like Boris Johnson, what the hell is he doing? Is he completely mad? We must stay indoors forever, versus the I'm going to go and breathe all over everyone is the earliest opportunity. If I can't lick a member of Right Said Fred's, that's my human right to do. It feels to me that we're not having, I mean, the part of the problem is what we really need is a grown-up conversation about risk and death. And maybe the one place not to have a grown-up conversation isn't on social media. But it seems as if the sort of absolutists are talking as if we're going to have zero COVID, zero cases, zero deaths. If only we just sit tight for a bit longer, then it'll all be all right. And that's just not realistic, is it?
David.
It's not only just not realistic, it's not actually how most people are thinking about it. Whilst it is true that people would like a kind of degree of clarity, because into the area of doubt creep all the kind of, am I doing the right thing? Am I under threat or not? And so on. And people don't like that. But we are entering, and we are in a period actually of what you might call ambiguity. And that ambiguity is because it's played around fairly fine margins of, let's say, how effective the vaccine is. If it's 97% effective against COVID, the new variants of COVID, that's one thing. If it's 94%, then that means rather more people will get it and rather more people will die. And then the question comes about what are the kind of minimal forms of restraints that you would want in order to try and cope with that. And so we're dealing still with a kind of period of uncertainty and trying to make our way through best guesses. And my feeling is that most people actually do, after all this time, understand that. But we are in the middle of the culture wars, and people will culture war just about anything. They'll culture war pets. They'll culture war. I mean, the two sides will actually kill each other and anybody in between, by the way, at the drop of a hat over any suit. Brexit applied to everything. Woke culture or anti-woke culture applied to absolutely everything. And my instinct about this, I know what Danny feels, despite one of the headlines that occupied the paper this week, is that increasingly people are going to get impatient with this this incredible battle that these two sides appear to be having for our souls, and say, I don't really want any part of this.
Danny.
Well, I'm going to be writing partly about that this week. You're right, David. the only reason why I'm not writing this particular column, and I'll tell you what it is in a second, is because I've written it several times already. We ought to have a clearer idea what the health costs are of continued lockdown. The people who are suggesting that we carry on locking down are doing that on the basis that it has no cost. I've always taken the idea that the costs of COVID spreading were so big in the past that, we could probably muddle along without analysis of what the costs of lockdown were, because they were bound to be smaller. But we've now reached the point where that's no longer the case. And I always knew that would happen. We are now making a case where the Prime Minister is having to choose about how many deaths he's willing to risk. But it's everyone suggesting that there's just sort of one choice between no deaths and however many deaths he's picked. That's not the case. There are real big costs in terms of the economy and in terms of health to lockdown. And it may not have been a problem. It may not have been a problem until now because of the costs of COVID. But now we're so heavily vaccinated, it is a choice. And it's very frustrating that we're making that choice with only one piece of information that we need. Now, I'm inclined to trust that Chris Whitty's point. He basically said we've reached the point where we're mainly delaying rather than avoiding deaths. And the judgment of some scientists is that we should keep going with the policy of restrictions, but the judgment of others, and it was clearly his, is that we should move now because we've got the summer ahead of us. And what he's indicating is it's a difficult choice to make, but we should make it. I wish I was able to, I'm willing to trust his judgment. I wish I was able to make it myself a bit more clearly upon the basis, not just of Chris Whitty's instinct about what will happen with COVID, but what would also happen with lockdown. And that's a piece of information that hasn't been shared with us. And I've found that frustrating all the way along. It hasn't been a big public policy decision problem, but now it is.
Now, let's move on, because I think I sort of owe you an apology, Danny, because I inadvertently, I'm not sure this has ever happened before, I inadvertently said something which was at odds with something that you thought, which I don't think, which very rarely happens. But on, I don't know what it was, I think Friday, I tweeted that of all the daft takes about Batley and Spen, the daftest was the idea that this had halted Boris Johnson's march, and that actually, you know, if the Tories are marching, even at this stage, that is mad. It should be the opposition on the march. And I hadn't read that you'd written exactly that, that one of the takeaways from it was that it was the Tories were, the march had been halted. But it was just interesting about the... about narratives and whether the narrative was that the Tories were on the march. No, they're not on the march, although I'm not sure that anything has happened before or since to suggest that Labour were on the march. So, first of all, go on, Danny.
Yeah, we can disagree with each other, and actually it's very...
No, we can't. We must fight to the death.
It was very healthy to see what you thought, but actually we didn't quite disagree, because what you were suggesting was that this by-election hasn't halted anything, and I agree with that. I just think this by-election... this by-election should mainly be seen by Labour as a relief that it was not a disaster, because it wasn't a particularly good result at all. One of the things it does indicate is that it may be the case, it only may be the case, that the Conservative Party is no longer doing what looked like it might be doing, which is continuing to hoover up these big votes for Brexit Party or independent Brexit-inclined candidates, and thus in the red wall seats, not merely not merely staying still or sometimes going backwards, we're actually advancing. Well, in this by-election, insofar as you can tell anything from one by-election, the indication was they didn't eat up that vote, and therefore they stayed static. And that was one of the pieces that Keir Starmer can be relieved about. But I think where we do agree is it wasn't a spectacular result by any means. And when I was working for William Hague, and William Hague's written about this a little bit this morning, you know, we had some results which were kind of mediocre, but we were happy because they looked like victories. But really, we understood they weren't very good results for the stage we were in the parliament, and were probably indicating we were on course to lose. But we took what we could get. And I think that was pretty much the case with Batley and Spen.
What do you think, David? Who's right? Is it me or Danny? Fight.
I think Danny should be careful next time he stands on the platform at Pinner, just in case you go on that tube as well. Because he said he's been kind of feeling shaky. So you wait for his glasses to steam up and then off he goes. I think, as with football, we're suffering from a crisis of overinterpretation, really, which is Harry Kane doesn't score for a couple of matches. Harry Kane is in a kind of absolute disaster. Harry Kane scores. This could be the opening of the floodgates. Harry Kane scores again. See, we told you. It's all nonsense because it's all kind of dependent upon what kind of service their forward gets. And this is all nonsense as well, really. There was a narrative which was Keir Starmer's in dead trouble, he's going to go, etc. And Batley and Spen has completely destroyed that. In that sense, it's a very big result for Labour because it completely gets rid of that particular thing which was building. I was interested, by the way, in which, however, quite a lot of commentators, having already bet their farms on Labour's crisis, continued with the Labour crisis narrative, despite the by-election, etc., as if it hadn't happened. And I suppose, in a way, that argues that actually they weren't overinterpreting because they were sticking with their original overinterpretation instead of re-overinterpreting and so on. And I'm going to say this point again, and I know it's really boring. These are not usual times. You can't go by the usual rules. Anything that William Hague went through, with respect, Danny, doesn't really tell you that much about what's going on now because the pandemic has completely done for everything. I don't think that the Times has run a single edition in the last kind of 4 months that hasn't had Boris Johnson photographed in a vaccination centre in it. Whereas Keir Starmer struggles to get on anybody's things unless he's actually suffering a crisis and so on. Now, we are going to edge out of that period. And I would say, I honestly do suggest this to people, wait another 6 months and then interpret. Because these have been the strangest of strange times.
I would agree with you. And actually, go a bit further. It's not just that we're early on in the parliament and we've had the vaccine bounce and all those things, all of which I think you're completely, 100% correct about. I would additionally point out, at some point, time for a change will visit the Conservative Party, just like it has every, it is a golden rule. It always comes. The pendulum effect always works. It's been the period has been extraordinary that it over the last 10 or 15 years that it hasn't come. I think it will. And I don't rule out at all that Labour will deprive the Conservative Party of its majority in the next election. I think winning a majority of its own seems unlikely. I think it'll face the problem when it gets close to an election that it'll be presenting people with quite a messy government if they get elected, and that could mean that they don't. But nevertheless, you're quite right, David. You shouldn't overinterpret this as saying Labour can't win or whatever. But I would say you certainly can't interpret it as anything other than you can as a useful event because it stopped all this discussion, but it's a pretty ropey result in truth for and that does have to be stared at. And I think it's partly because, for all sorts of reasons, both temporary, but I think also more than temporary, Keir Starmer doesn't dominate the scene in a way that I thought he might actually. And I thought this might play to his strengths, sort of presenting himself as the sort of person who can become prime minister. And it must have struck you, David, that for all his reasonableness, that attribute, it hasn't come through as clearly as you would have.
Well, it's also,
as I anticipated. Is that not the case?
He's not a film star. And that is a bit of a problem, which is that he starts opening his mouth. He doesn't make you lean into him. Yeah. That's absolutely true. There is a quality. Blair had it. Thatcher, to a certain extent, had it in a kind of different way, which is, and in the completely malign sense, Trump has it in spades, which is you go towards him when he speaks. When Keir speaks, you lean outwards a bit. It's a very strange, and it feels kind of unfair, and it may be the experience of some success would change that and so on. But you fear that really, actually, his best position in a team is central defence.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to lean out of listening to both of you, but only because we've run out of time and not because it wasn't fascinating. Danny Finkelstein and David Ivanovich there. And, of course, you can read The Times every week. Danny on a Wednesday, David on a Thursday. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, Mr. Politics of Petrol.
Cool fact, A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now, when was the last time you filled up?
First, let's go big picture. What is driving this rise in the price of oil? Let's speak to Paul Stevens, Distinguished Fellow at Chatham House and an expert on the economics of oil. Morning, Paul.
Good morning.
So let's talk proper nuts and bolts. Right back at the beginning, the price of oil, who decides the price of oil?
Basically the marketplace. And the marketplace is populated by a large number of excitable 23-year-olds in red braces. So this explains why it can get so volatile.
They are the worst. And so this is literally sort of barrels of oil being traded on the market.
Yeah, sometimes it's pieces of paper with promises to pay or deliver that are traded, but you also get a physical market as well where people actually exchange barrels of oil.
And what has been happening to oil prices in the past sort of 12, 18 months? What impact did the pandemic have?
The pandemic had a huge impact, largely because oil demand collapsed. And as a result of that, prices collapsed. Indeed, at one point last year, the price of oil in the United States went negative. In other words, they had to pay people to take it away. Since then, as the pandemic, I was going to say the pandemic has retreated, but it hasn't. But as demand has started to come back, then prices have started to creep up again. And indeed, in the last week or so, they've been at their highest level since about 2018.
So that's crept back up. And then what is there a direct correlation between the price of a barrel of oil and what we pay at the pumps? Is it one of those things that is the price of oil shoots up, the price at the pumps shoots up, and then the price of oil comes down quickly and the price at the pumps comes down quite slowly?
There is an element of sort of asymmetric response, if you like, but it's worth remembering that in the United Kingdom, for example, when you go and fill up your car, about two-thirds of that goes to the UK government in tax. The actual price of oil accounts for only about less than a third of the price of the gasoline.
And I suppose that's been one of the big debates, isn't it? Is the amount of tax and fuel duty that the government puts on it, and that actually makes up a bigger proportion. What's the sort of, aside from the fact they're all 23 and wear red braces, what's the long term sort of forecast for oil? If the entire globe presumably it is forecast to shift more towards electric cars. Will that have an impact on the oil price?
It certainly will. It's not so much electric vehicles, because that's only part of the demand for oil. But we are in the middle of an energy transition, a move away from hydrocarbon molecules towards electrons. And this will have a very significant impact on the demand for oil ultimately. And indeed, there is a view now that I hold, and also other people like BP hold, that we've reached so-called peak oil. In other words, world oil demand is now at the maximum it's ever going to be, and therefore it's downhill from here on in. How fast downhill depends on the speed of the transition.
Well, we wait to see what actually happens there. Paul Stevens, Distinguished Fellow at Chatham House, thanks so much for joining us. Good to speak to Paul there. Do let me know what you think about this. Somebody's texted in, no name on this. I want to get out of my car, but it's so difficult. The cost of trains are insane. Where I live, I don't have a great bus network. I want to go electric, but the cars are so expensive. So what's the government doing? They don't do anything to enable us. So keep your thoughts coming in. 8722, start your message with the word Times. So there's a bit, it's the global picture we got from Paul, exactly how oil prices feed through to the pumps. But then what's going on at the pumps, and how much do prices vary from different parts of the country, maybe on different roads even? Earlier on, I spoke to Simon Williams. He's the RAC's fuel spokesman. And I asked him about how much the price of petrol varies at different retailers.
The price of petrol will vary quite considerably. There's somewhat of a postcode lottery with fuel. But generally, fuel will be cheaper when there's a presence of a supermarket. Yeah, and that would also be better if there was one or two supermarkets and several retailers, so there's a bit of competition. Generally, supermarket fuel is around 3 to 4p a litre cheaper than fuel bought elsewhere, although there are some independent retailers that do really pride themselves on having a good price and do give the supermarkets a run for their money.
So if that's the average, where's the sort of highest and lowest petrol that people could be buying right now?
Motorway fuel will clearly be the most expensive, but people don't tend to do a complete fill up there. It tends to be something much more akin to what we call a splash and dash, and then filling up elsewhere.
That's a good term.
Somewhere more.
That's the oh blimey, I need petrol. I'll just put in £10 of this phenomenally expensive motorway petrol.
Yeah, it's also good to make sure you, when you're doing a longer journey, you know you're going to need to fill up at some point, to research in advance where you could do that, which might be a little bit more affordable.
What's the highest you're seeing at the moment?
It's very difficult to talk about. We don't tend to talk about individual highest prices. We know that we are in a situation where we've had rising fuel prices for 8 months in a row. As you said, 18p a litre has been added. That's added £10 a litre to the cost of filling up an average 55 litre family car with petrol or diesel since the beginning of November last year. And it looks like we're heading for probably 9 months of rises as well. Things aren't looking good this month. But we are still some way off the all-time highs of April 2012, when petrol reached 142 a litre and diesel 148.
What drove those high prices back in 2012?
The oil price. And of course, the all-time high oil price is around $115 a barrel. But of course, at the beginning of the pandemic, when there was no demand for oil at all, oil fell to $13 a barrel. And now if we cast our minds back to 2016, when we had commonly available petrol and diesel at £1 a litre, oil fell to $26 a barrel. And that was due to OPEC, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, overproducing oil, with a view to stopping America gaining market share from fracking. Now, that was something we never thought we'd see. But of course, at that time, we were all driving. But during the beginning of the pandemic, no one was moving. So no one really benefited, or not many people benefited from the low oil price then.
And what are the long-term prospects? Do you think that it might continue to rise for a couple of months? I mean, how high do you think it might go this time? Do you think we will see 2012 levels?
It's very, very difficult to predict. Oil prices are extremely volatile. And of course, what's happening now is that producers are trying to balance the market, and demand is growing. And at the moment, is outstripping supply. But of course, various countries around the world are at different stages of vaccination rollouts. And you know, the Delta variants, you know, taking a hold. So it's quite hard for them, you know, to work out exactly how much is needed. But I think on the whole, they're kind of making the prices go up. But they're all, things could change.
And how big an impact?
It's very hard to predict.
How big an impact might the move to some forms of hybrid work? I mean, clearly lots of people have still been going to work throughout the pandemic. Some people will be going back to work, you know, back to their place of work full time. But if there are people who used to drive to work 5 days a week, maybe be doing it a couple of days a week, how big an impact would that ultimately have, do you think, on the number of cars that are on the road and the amount of petrol that we buy?
It clearly could have an impact on traffic. I don't think ultimately, I think, it probably won't harm overall petrol and diesel sales that much, because I think what will happen, from certainly from research we carried out, I think people will actually end up doing more leisure driving. They perhaps may not be going to the office on a couple of days a week, but they'll probably make up for it driving elsewhere. So we might see differences in traffic at different times of day. The rush hour may not be quite as bad, but government statistics also show that we're pretty much back to the level of traffic we had just prior to the pandemic in February 2012.
And looking ahead, obviously there's a move to get everyone to go electric, you know, some people getting hybrid cars, others going full-blown electric. What impact will, do you think that this rise in petrol prices might encourage more people to make that switch, or does it have to go to sort of £2 a litre before that becomes a real consideration?
I think the rising prices will make some people think. Obviously, the 2030 date is set now for the end of the sale of new petrol and diesel cars. It is definitely an incentive to switch to electric. If you think about driving, you know, someone who drives 10,000 miles a year at the average price of £1.32 for petrol a litre, you could be saving around £1,500. That's probably based on an MPG of about 40 miles to the gallon. That makes, you know, switching to electric look pretty attractive, because you won't, you know, electricity is cheap, and so much so that we've actually introduced a leasing offer on our website to lease an EV, and you can get into an EV for as little as £230 a month, which is, you know, makes electric motoring seem far more appealing than internal combustion engine motoring.
That was Simon Williams from the RAC talking us through what's happening at the pumps. Up next, we're going to look at the politics of petrol. And for years, Conservative chancellors, successive Conservative chancellors, have frozen fuel duty. But if they want us all to go electric, maybe they should hike it up. We'll talk that next here on Times Radio. This is Matt Chorley on Times Radio in association with GoDaddy, providing the help and tools you need to grow your business online.
Mariella Frostrup, this afternoon from 1 on Times Radio.
We've discussed at length the future of the workplace in the post-pandemic world, but what about how the job market is changing? What will be the professions of the future? Just how radical a change are we in for? At 2pm, we're joined by Anthony Gormley, the artist whose sculptures are recognised across the world, including his 200-tonne Angel of the North. We also speak with Candice Braithwaite, who took the country by storm with her first book, I'm Not Your Baby Mother, and returns with a fearless collection of essays on all the things she wishes she'd been told when she was young. That would be a massive tome if it was me.
Mariella Frostrup, this afternoon from 1 on Times Radio.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio with GoDaddy, supporting the small business champions behind Team GB at the Tokyo Olympic Games.
Yeah, good morning. We're talking petrol in the big thing today. After petrol prices, according to the RAC, the average litre of unleaded petrol is now 132.19p. That's the highest price in nearly 8 years. Prices up 20% on this time last year. Well, government taxes, fuel duty and VAT already make up about two-thirds of the overall cost of both petrol and diesel. And despite the increase in prices, the government remains under pressure to increase fuel duty to try to limit the number of cars on the road and hit its environmental goals. Well, The Times, a couple of days ago, reported that ministers have drawn up radical plans to reduce carbon emissions, which would increase the cost of running a car by hundreds of pounds a year. The government plans to introduce a carbon reduction scheme that will put up the cost of gas and petrol as part of an attempt to decarbonise the economy. Under the plans, the average cost of running a petrol car could rise by more than £100 a year.
According to the RAC, a driver covering 10,000 miles a year spends £1,500 on petrol. Well, the Times have been told that Boris Johnson does not want to include petrol in the scheme amid concerns it would penalise motorists. He, like his predecessors, knows the political cost of targeting drivers. There is a reason why chancellors for more than a decade have repeatedly promised that fuel duty would be frozen.
We will now stop any rise in fuel duty this August and freeze it for the rest of the year. Yeah.
And I will, Mr. Deputy Speaker, once again cancel the fuel duty rise for both petrol and diesel that is scheduled for April.
I'm not prepared to increase the cost of a tank of fuel. So the planned increase in fuel duty is also cancelled.
George Osborne, Philip Hammond and Rishi Sunak set to the music of Frozen there. You don't get that anywhere else, do you? Possibly for good reason. But time and again, they've frozen planned rises in fuel duty. But maybe the mood in government is changing. If they did act to put up the price of driving, what impact would that have? Let's speak to Douglas McWilliams, Executive Deputy Chairman at the Centre for Economics and Business Research. Morning, Douglas.
Good morning.
So talk us through the economics of this and the impact of rising fuel prices up to something like 20% in recent months. What impact would that have on the economy, even before the government starts looking at potentially pushing up the cost of driving?
Well, the rise in fuel prices on its own takes out about 1% of GDP growth from the economy. But the economy is growing pretty quickly at the moment, so that's probably not the Chancellor's biggest concern. I think what probably would be his concern is that fuel prices are paid much more by people outside London, 92% outside London, and much more by relatively poorer people. The poorest 10% of motorists spend 8% of their income on fuel, whereas the richest only spend 4%. So I think that that would be the sort of thing that would concern the Chancellor.
And is that why? Because I'll be honest, even when I was discussing it earlier on with colleagues, and they said, why are you doing that? And I said, because I know, grew up on the Somerset Levels, I live in Hampshire, you know, everybody drives. Everyone talks about, have you seen the price of petrol? But because, bluntly, most people in London do not drive, there's not a national conversation about this in a way that if train fares or tube fares went up by 20% in 12 months, it probably would be all over the front pages.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think also motorists feel slightly that they are paying the bulk of the decarbonisation efforts. I mean, the ONS statistics say that that motorists are paying 68% of all climate change taxes, whereas they only account for between 15 and 20%, depending which measure you use, of emissions. And so there's a feeling that it's not quite fair. And it's the people who live outside London and the people who are poor and not necessarily very articulate are the ones who are getting it in the neck. I mean, I don't frankly mind paying a bit extra because, you know, I think I can afford it. But there are plenty of people who can't afford it. And they seem to be the ones who are getting most upset about this.
And I suppose the thing is that if you live in a rural or semi-rural area, and you need your car to get to work, the government could keep putting it all up and keep saying you've got to pay more of your carbon, you know, your contributions towards our carbon change. It's not going to make any difference unless it's become so cripplingly expensive that actually the idea of buying a hybrid or an electric car makes you start thinking about making the switch.
Yeah, and of course the problem is that there isn't still a very good second-hand market for hybrid and electric cars, and they're still fairly expensive. So roughly half the population could, if they really wanted to, substitute their current spending on petrol or diesel cars for electric or, in some cases, hybrid ones. But the other half would have to pay quite a lot more if they want to get an electric car compared with what they're spending at the moment.
But yeah, it's sort of the initial outlay. And the government said that it's going to the ban on the sale of pure internal combustion engines that ban's going to come into force now in 2030. New hybrid cars will still be allowed to be sold until 2035. So we're some way off that sort of. It's going to be a while, isn't it, before you know electric cars of one sort or another dominate on our roads.
The hope is that by then the technology is improved, and the technology needs to improve in a number of areas. First of all, to bring down the price. Secondly, to speed up charging times, because charging times at the moment mean that if you're trying to do something and your car needs to be charged, it's not much use to you. And the third thing that's required at the same time is much more efficient batteries that are smaller, put on less weight, etc. If you can do those things together and bring down the cost, it starts to become a much more attractive proposition.
Well, we'll see how that all pans out. Really good to speak to Douglas McWilliams there from the Centre for Economics and Business Research. Let's now talk to Katharina Brandmeier, the Head of Climate Policy at the Green Alliance. Good morning, Katharina.
Good morning.
So what would you like to see happen? In terms of, in a sort of pure green sense, it would make sense, wouldn't it, for the government to really ratchet up fuel duty?
So I would start by saying that there are significant benefits from transitioning to a clean and more modern transport systems, including the health benefits that can arise from greater sort of active travel, so walking and cycling, the job creation in new low carbon industries for EV manufacturing, charging infrastructure deployment and public transport expansion, as well as lower congestion and air quality. But what is crucial in sort of moving to that future transport system is that we put equity at the center of it. And the way that obviously government designs policy and taxation plays a vital role in ensuring that all parts of society and all parts of the country can benefit from those, from that future and during the transition. And it's in that context, it's important to recognize that taxation plays an important role, but it's on the one hand, it needs to be well designed to avoid those least able to pay to be sort of be disproportionately impacted. And on the other hand, taxation alone cannot solve the problem. And it must be complemented by a set of supportive measures that also allow people to switch to cleaner alternatives. And this means making sure that people have access to public transport, that they can walk and cycle if they want to. And it's also easier for them to switch to electric vehicles. And I think that is therefore vital that government, as it's provide sort of thinks about changing taxation in the transport system, it looks at this and it sets out a comprehensive package of measures to make sure that sort of all of these different aspects around equity are really considered and embedded in the system.
And what about the point that Douglas was just making? That at the moment, the amount of money that's paid by drivers, the tax, the VAT, the carbon contributions, actually, as a proportion of the amount of money they're giving to the government, far outweighs the contribution to carbon emissions. And it's quite often poorer people, especially, who are forking out the most. Does the government sort of need to almost go back to square one instead of this sort of, you know, annual ritual of Tory MPs saying don't put up fuel duty and the Chancellor says, oh, so I'm fine, I'll freeze it again for another year? Do we need to go right back to square one and completely rethink tax, transport taxes right across the board, so that there is a proper incentive, you know, people are incentivised to go green rather than just penalised for not being able to?
So I think it's first worth pointing out that there is it's true that there is an uneven sort of carbon price across the economy, and I think it would be definitely desirable for government to take a much more comprehensive approach to make sure that the entire tax system is first of all aligned to support growth, economic growth towards a clean economy, and making sure the tax system is also designed to overall be a sort of a system that is not penalizing, that it's a fair system and it's not penalizing those least able to pay. And I should say that research the Green Alliance has conducted with Britain Thinks shows that people are supportive of a tax system that helps tackle climate change. And these findings are also backed up by recommendations by the recent UK Climate Assembly, which shows that over 80% of people are supportive of green taxes on producers, products and services. But what is vital is to make sure that taxation is designed well to sort of mitigate and minimize and mitigate where possible the impacts of those least able to pay, and instead sort of targets eventually those that instead are in the wealthy brackets. But on the other hand, that we do put in place, we don't rely just on taxation, and we do put in place a whole set of supportive measures to make sure that everyone, and particularly those least able to pay, have access to cleaner alternatives.
Well, it's an interesting debate, and I'm sure it's one that the government is going to have to grapple with sooner rather than later. Katharina Brandmeier from Green Alliance, thanks so much for joining us on Times Radio.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcast from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr and Mrs.
Oh, no,
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.